Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Housewifely Arts by Megan Mayhew Bergman. I am my own housewife, my own breadwinner. I make lunches and change light bulbs. I kiss bruises and kill copperheads from the backyard creek with a steel hoe. I change sheets and the oil in my car. I can make a pie crust and exterminate humpback crickets in the crawl space with a homemade glue board, though not at the same time. I like to compliment myself on these things because there's no one else around to do it. "Turn left," Ike says in a falsetto British accent. There is no left, only a Carolina road that appears infinitely flat, surrounded by pines and the occasional car dealership billboard. I lost my mother last spring and am driving 9 hours south on I-95 with a 7-year-old so that I might hear her voice again. "Exit approaching," he says from the back seat. "Bear right." "Who are you today?" I ask. "The lady that lives in the GPS," Ike says. "Mary Poppins." My son is a 43-pound drama queen, a mercurial shrimp of a boy who knows many of the words to Andrew Lloyd Webber's oeuvre. He draws two eyes and a mouth on the fogged-up window. "Baby, don't do that unless you have Windex in your backpack," I say. "Can you turn this song up?" he says. I watch him croon in the rearview mirror. He vogues like Madonna in his booster seat. His white blonde shag swings with the bass. "You should dress more like Gwen Stefani," he says. I picture myself in LeMay hot pants and thigh highs. "Do you need to pee?" I ask. "We could stop for lunch." Ike sighs and pushes my old Wayfarers into his hair. "Chicken nuggets?" he asks. If I were a better mother, I would say no. If I were a better mother, there would be a Ziploc baggie in a cooler with a crustless PB&J, a plastic bin of carrot wedges and seedless grapes. If I were a better daughter, Ike would have known his grandmother, spent more time in her arms, wowed her with his impersonation of Christopher Plummer's Captain Von Trapp. "How many eggs could a pterodactyl lay at one time?" Ike asks. "Probably no more than one," I say. "One pterodactyl is enough for any mother." "How much longer?" Ike asks.
4 hours.
4 hours till what?"
"You'll see," I say.
What I'm having trouble explaining to Ike is this. We're driving to a small roadside zoo outside of Myrtle Beach so that I can hear my mother's voice ring through the beak of a 36-year-old African gray parrot, a bird I hated, a bird that could beep like a microwave, ring like a phone, and sneeze just like me. In moments of profound starvation, the exterminator told me, humpback crickets may devour their own legs, though they cannot regenerate limbs. "Hell of a party trick," I said. Our house has been for sale for 1 year and 2 months, and a contract has finally come in contingent on a home inspection. The firm I work for has offered to transfer me to Connecticut, a paralegal supervisory position in a state where Ike has a better chance of escaping childhood obesity, God, and conservative political leanings. I can't afford to leave until the house sells. My realtor has tried scented candles, 12 valances, and apple pies in the oven, but no smokescreen will detract from the cricket infestation. "They jump," the realtor said before I left town with Ike. "Whenever I open the door to the basement, they hurl themselves at me." "You'll never pass a home inspection," he said. "They're like spiders on steroids. Do something." "The exterminator already comes weekly," I said, "and I've installed sodium vapor bulbs." "I'll see you Sunday," the realtor said, walking to his compact convertible, his shirt crisp and tucked neatly into his pressed pants. "I'll come over for a walkthrough before the inspection." That night, Ike and I covered scrap siding in glue and flypaper and scattered our torture devices throughout the basement, hoping to reduce the number of crickets. "You're coming down later to get the bodies," Ike said, "because I'm not." He shivered and stuck out his tongue at the crickets, which flung themselves from wall to ledge to ceiling. "What if we live here forever?" he asked. "People used to do that," I said, "live in one house their entire life. My mother, for instance." I pictured her house, a 2-bedroom white ranch with window boxes, brick chimney, and decorative screen door.
The driveway was unpaved, an arc of sand, grass, and crushed oyster shells that led to a tin-covered carport. Growing up, there was no neighborhood, only adjoining farms and country lots with rambling cow pastures. People didn't landscape in fancy ways then. Mom had tended her azaleas and boxwoods with half-hearted practicality in case the chickens or sheep broke loose. The house, recently bought by a corporate real estate firm, was empty now, a tiny exoskeleton on a tree-cleared lot next to a Super Walmart. I thought about Mom then and her parrot. If we move, this might be my last time to hear her voice. I pulled into a rest stop, one of those suspicious gas station and fast food combos. Ike kicks the back of the passenger seat. I scowl in the rear view. I need to stretch, he says. I have a cramp. Ike's legs are the size of my wrist, hairless and pale. He is sweet and unassuming. He does not yet know he will be picked on for being undersized, for growing facial hair 10 years too late. I want to wrap him in plastic and preserve him so that he can always be this way, this content. To my heart, Ike is still a neonate, a soft body I could gently fold and carry inside of me again. You can just see the innocence falling off a child's face every day. Ike and I lock the car and head into the gas station. A burly man with black hair curling across his shoulders hustles into the restroom. He breathes hard, scratches his ear, and checks his phone. Next, a sickly-looking man whose pants are too big shuffles inside. He pauses to wipe his forehead with an elbow. I think, these people are someone's children. I clench Ike's hand. I can feel his knuckles, the small bones beneath his flesh. Inside, the toilets hiss. I hold Ike by the shoulders. I do not want him to go in alone. Garlic burst, he reads from a cellophane bag. Big flavor! I play with his cowlick. When he was born, I could see a whorl of hair on the crown of his head like a small stagnant hurricane. Ike also had what the nurse called stork bites on the back of his neck and eyelids. The things my body had done to him, I think. Cancer genes, hay fever, high blood pressure, perhaps a fear of math. These are my gifts. I have to pee, he says. I release him, let him skip into the fluorescent germ-infested cave, a room slick with mistakes and full of the type of men I hope he'll never become. The first time I met my mother's parrot, he clung to a wrought iron perch on the front porch as we ate breakfast outside. Claiming the house was too quiet, Mom adopted Carney from a neighbor 1 month after Dad's funeral and constructed an extensive cage for him both indoors and out. Carney could already imitate the sound of oncoming traffic, an ambulance siren, leaves rustling, the way Pete Sampras hit a tennis ball on TV. He could replicate my mother's voice completely, her contralto imitations of Judy Garland and Reba McEntire, the way she answered the phone. What are you selling? I'm not interested. The bird moved from his perch to my shoulder without permission. Mom, I said, get this damn bird off of me. Language, she warned. He's a sponge. I was still grieving Dad, and it was strange to watch Mom find so much joy in this ebony-beaked wise-ass. What are you selling? He said. I already have car insurance. Carney spoke with perfect inflection, but he addressed his words to the air. A song, not conversation. You can't take anything personally, Mom warned. The man of the house is not here, Carney said. He's dead. You really take it easy on those telemarketers, I said, looking at Mom. Dead, 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 Carney said. That night he shredded the newspaper in his enclosure, which smelled like a stable. Lights out, Mom said, and tossed a threadbare beach towel over his cage. Carney belted out the first verse of Patsy Cline's Walkin' After Midnight, then fell silent for the evening. His parlor tricks seemed cheap, and I hated the easy way he'd endeared himself to Mom. Later that week, Carney became violently protective of her. Wings clipped, he chased me on foot through the halls and hid behind door frames, not realizing his beak stuck out beyond the molding. As I tried to shoo him from the kitchen counter, he savagely bit my wrist and fingers. Then, days later, as if exchanged for a new bird, Carney lightened up and preened my hair while perched on the back of the couch. I'll take him to a specialist, Mom said, mildly apologetic for her bird's bipolar antics. She was a perfectionist, and I knew she wanted a bird she could be proud of, but I think part of her was flattered by Carney's aggressive loyalty. Show me how you pet the bird, the behaviorist had said. Carney, inching left and right on Mom's wrist, cocked his head to one side and shot us the eye. Like a whale, he gave us one side of his face at a time, revealing a tiny yellow iris, one that looked out at the world with remarkable clarity, ensconced in a white mask the size of a thumbprint. Mom ran her pointer finger down Carney's chest. "I don't know how to tell you this," the behaviorist said, "but you've been sexually stimulating your parrot." Mom blushed. "Inadvertently," the behaviorist said. "Of course." "He thinks I'm his mate?" Mom asked. "Less cuddling," the specialist said. "More cage time." I called three places to find Carney, the plumber who took him after Mom, the bird sanctuary he'd pawned the parrot off on, then the roadside zoo. Now the car is too warm and I'm falling asleep, but I don't want to blast Ike with the AC. He's playing card games on the console. "Are we leaving so that people can move into our house?" Ike asks. "We're going to Ted's roadside zoo," I say. "Go fish," Ike says. "What's at the zoo?" "There's a bird I want to see," I say. "What," he asks, "is gin rummy?" We pass a couple in a sedan. The woman is crying and flips down her visor. It's hard being a single mom, but it's easier than being a miserable wife. I hardly knew Ike's father. He was what I'd call a five-night stand. We used to get coffee at the same place before work. A director of the local college theater, he was a notorious flirt but already married. Separated, he'd claimed. He sends a little money each month but doesn't want to be involved. The upside to our arrangement is simplicity. I put some pressure on the gas and pass a school bus. "Did I tell you about Lewis's mom?" Ike says. "How she got on the bus last week?" Lewis's mom is a born-again Christian with two poodles and a coke habit, the kind of person I avoid at t-ball games and open houses at school. "Tuesday afternoon," Ike says, "she boarded the bus with her dogs, raised her fist and said, 'Christ is risen. Indeed, he is risen.'" "No," I say, "really?" Ike pauses for a minute, as if he needs time to conjure the scene. "Really," Ike says. "Lewis pretended not to know her when she got on, but his mom held on to that chrome bar at the front of the bus and said, 'Lord, I've been places where people don't put pepper on their eggs,' and she started to dance." Ike waves his arms in front of his face, fingers spread, imitating Lewis's strung-out mother. I see the rust-colored clouds of eczema on his forearms. I want to fix everything. I want him to know nothing but gentle landings. I don't want him to know that people like Lewis's mom exist, that people fall into landmines of pain and can't crawl back out. When Ike was almost a year old, I took him by for Mom to hold while I emptied the old milk from her fridge and scrubbed her toilets. The house was beginning to smell. Mom was not cleaning up after the bird. Suddenly, the woman who'd ironed tablecloths, polished silver, bleached dinner napkins, and rotated mattresses had given up on decorum. "Would you like to hold Ike while I clean?" I said. Mom sat in a brown leather recliner, Carney in his white lacquered cage a foot away from her, almost always within sight. She was losing weight, and I worried she wasn't eating well. I brought cartons of cottage cheese and chicken salad, only to find them spoiled the following month. "Are you trying to sell my house?" she said. "Are you giving realtors my number? They're calling with offers." "There's a shopping center going in next door," I said. "This may be your chance to sell." I placed Ike in her arms. "It's not hard to lose the baby weight," Mom said, eyeing my waistline, "if you try." I was determined not to fight back. There was heat between us, long-standing arguments we could still feel burning. Should we sell Dad's tools? Should she go to the eye doctor? Who would care for her goddamn bird? Didn't I know how hard they'd work to give me the right opportunities? Our disagreements were so sharp, so intense, that we'd become afraid to engage with each other, and when we stopped fighting, we lost something. "You're like your father now," she said. "You never get mad, even when you want to." It was true. Dad was hard to anger, even when I'd wasted $15,000 of his hard-earned money my freshman year of college at a private school they couldn't afford. The night I came home for the summer, he sat with his hands in his lap and a look on his face that was more sad than disappointed. Mom stood behind him, silent and threatening. I knew later she'd berate him for taking it easy on me, and I hated her for it. "I guess you'll need to get a job," he said. "Dad," I said, "I made a lot of mistakes this year." "I wanted to give you a good chance," he said, looking down at his fingers. I remember feeling relieved that he wasn't yelling at me. Now I wish he had. "I'd do it again," he said, "but you understand, there just isn't enough money." I tortured myself imagining each of his hours. He worked at the same plant for 26 years making industrial-quality tools, hammers, chisels, knives, clamps. Every day he ate a cold lunch on a bench caked with pigeon shit. I could almost hear the echoes of men moving and talking, their spoken lives bouncing from the plant rafters as their hands worked. The black hole of his effort, the way it would never be enough or easy, it hung over me, a debt I couldn't pay. Mom ran her fingers over Ike's cowlick. I emptied the trash can in the kitchen, then the living room. "While you're at it," she said, "would you change the newspaper in Carney's cage and top off his water?" As I approached the bird's cage, he let out a piercing cry, his black beak open. I held my hand up as if to say, "Stop." "Cut it," I said. "Put your hand down," Mom said. "You're scaring him." Carney continued to scream. It was a pleading, horrifying sound, like an alarm. He cocked his head and danced across his bar, shrieking. Ike began to cry. "Never mind," Mom said. "I'll do it." She thrust Ike in my arms and marched toward the cage. When she opened the door, Carney scampered onto her finger and she brought him to her shoulder. He was silent. Mom pulled the newsprint from the bottom of his cage with bare hands. Dried bird shit fell to the carpet. She didn't seem to notice. "Let me help you," I said. "Sit down. I can do this." "Sit down," Carney said. "Sit down. Sit down." Mom ignored me and moved to the kitchen, stuffing the soiled papers into the trash can. "You should wash your hands," I said. "Don't tell me what to do," she said. "Sit down," Carney said. "Sit down." I found Carney's high-volume pleas disconcerting and worried. They agitated Ike, who clung to my shoulder. There were things, once, that I thought I deserved. My parents' money, and certainly their unconditional love. But as years passed, our love had turned into a bartering system, a list of complicated IOUs. "I'm sorry," I said. "I don't know about birds." "You'll learn," Mom said, "soon." Ike and I arrive in Myrtle Beach at 8 p.m. I know the zoo will be closed at this hour, so we find a day's inn. There's something about the hum of an ice machine and waterlogged astroturf that takes me back to childhood. Ike faceplants onto the bed before I can remove the comforter. "Wait a second, baby," I say. "Let me get that dirty thing off." We get in bed and flip channels. Ike holds the fabric of my pajama legs with one hand, wraps the other around a blanket my mother crocheted for me when I was in college. His travel blanket. I'm racked with sadness every time I see it. The coral and black starburst, the tight knots. I remember a hotel I stayed in with my mother during her own mother's funeral. Downtown Norfolk, 1986. There was a rotating bucket of chicken on a sign pole below our window. I watched it spin. Even when the lights were off and my mother cried into her pillow, I watched that bucket of chicken rotate like the world itself. At the time, I thought that moms were not allowed to be sad, that surely women grew out of sadness by the time they had children. "Mom," Ike says, "I don't want to move." His eyes flicker and he fades. The news is on. A lipstick shellacked anchor tells of a new breed of aggressive python in southern Florida that strangled a toddler in his sleep. Maybe one will come to our hotel, I think, and I will have to fight it off with my pocket knife, club it with the glass lamp on the bedside table, offer it my own body. On our second date, Ike's father showed me a video of an infant in Andhra Pradesh. The child had rich brown skin and curious eyes. He pulled himself across a grass mat while a cobra, hood spread, hovered above the boy's soft body. The baby grabbed after the cobra's tail while the toothless snake struck him repeatedly on his downy head, snapping down upon his body like a whip. "This," Ike's father said, "is how you cultivate the absence of fear. Don't you wish someone had given you that gift?" "Fear keeps me safe," I said. "Snakes, why do I think of these things before I try to fall asleep?" I put one arm across Ike's chest so that I will know if he moves. I can feel the pattern of his breath. The calm and easy way he sleeps, the simple way he dreams. "When I moved out," Mom had said, "I need you to take Carney." It was a 100th time she'd asked. We had her bills and bank statements spread out on the coffee table. Her eyesight was failing, and we knew she couldn't live alone much longer. It was time to plan. Carney hung upside down in his cage. Empty seed casings and shredded newspaper littered the floor. Occasionally he pecked his image in a foil mirror, rang a bell with his beak. "I don't want the bird," I said. "He hates me. He's drawn blood, for Christ's sake." "If you loved me," Mom said, "you'd take him. I can't sleep without knowing he's safe and taken care of." "That's what you get," I said, "for buying a bird with a life expectancy longer than your own." "You know," she said. Then she stopped, as if she were afraid of what she'd say next. I'd always felt Mom's vision of perfection was outdated. I was never the ruddy-faced, pure-of-heart Girl Scout with the 4-H approved sheep-grooming skills that she'd been. I failed home ec and took a liking to underground hip-hop and traveling jam bands, dyed my hair blue with Kool-Aid one high school summer. In college, I got a tattoo of a purple Grateful Dead bear on the back of my neck, which had infuriated Mom when she saw it. When Ike was little, he used to lift my hair until he found the purple bear hiding underneath. At least someone liked it. In Mom's eyes, atonement was more than walking the line, more than surfacing from the typical angst-ridden throes of adolescence and early scholastic failures. Atonement included my adoption of a bird I couldn't trust around my son, a bird I'd hated for over a decade. "I don't trust the bird around Ike, and I can't handle the mess, the noise." Mom was silent. "I'll give Carney to the plumber," Mom said, collecting herself. "He's always liked Carney." "I wish I could take him," I said. "Lying doesn't help," Mom said. Even before I see it, Ted's roadside zoo depresses me. We park outside. The entrance is a plaster lion's face. We walk through its mouth. On the lion's right canine, someone has written, "Jenny is a midget whore." "This place smells like pee," Ike says. It's 9 a.m., but it feels like Ted's place isn't open. I've yet to see an employee. We walk a sand and gravel path, faux palm trees overhead. I've heard stories about these places, how they keep big cats in small enclosures, how the animals often have ingrown nails and 0% body fat. I have the urge to call out, "Mom?" as if I'm coming home after a long day. We find a man feeding a seal. "Where are your birds?" I ask. "Specifically, your African gray." "We have two," he says, "over by the vending machines." "I need the one named Carney," I say, "the one you received from the Red Oak Bird Sanctuary." "I think it's the one on the left," he says. "They all look alike, you know." I hone in on Carney's knowing eye, the white mask. He looked like the same bird, though his eyes had yellowed and his gray feathers had worn thin around his neck. "Carney," I say. "Carney, Carney, good boy. What do you want for dinner?" I pull out a pack of sunflower seeds I had purchased at the Zip Mart down the road. I look at the white down on the bird's chest and think, Mom's voice is in there. Ike closes in on the cage. He waves his hands in front of the parrot's face. The sign on Carney's cage reads, "African gray parrots are as smart as a 3-year-old." "I don't believe it," Ike says. "Carney," I ask, "want to sing some Patsy?" For half an hour, Ike and I coo and speak and dance, but the bird doesn't say a word. Beneath this wall of gray feathers is the last shard of my mother, and I feel myself growing increasingly desperate. How thick was her accent? Was her singing as beautiful as I remember? She always spoke sweetly to Carney, and I wanted to hear that sugary tone, the one she hadn't used with me in her last years. "How do you know this is the right bird?" Ike asks. "I did my research," I say, "and he hates me. He's spiting me with silence." "Please talk," Ike says to Carney. Carney bobs his head up and down and bites his leg, a gesture that strikes me as the bird equivalent of thumbing one's nose. "Just say something," I think. "Anything. Just let me hear her again." I'm surprised when I remember phone numbers and the alphabetical listing of all 50 states, the way I can summon Deuteronomy like a song on a long run. But I can't recall the funny way Mom said roof for Clorox. Not the rhyme she used to say about bad breath or the toothpaste jingle she had stuck in her head for 2 years. Not the sound of the way she said good night. The longer Carney goes without talking, the more I miss her. The morning we moved Mom into a home, the plumber came for Carney. Mom's possessions had been boxed up and her furniture sold. She'd prepared a box for Carney that contained his food, toys, water dish, spare newsprint, and a fabric square from one of her dresses. "So he remembers me," she said. "The kids are excited," the plumber said. He was tall and large and moved quickly. I was thankful for his efficiency. "I'll be in the car," Mom said, letting herself out of the house. The screen door shut behind her with metallic resonance as it had thousands of times. I didn't like letting her descend the steps on her own, but I knew in this moment she'd refuse help. I took the box she'd made for Carney and followed the plumber to his car, dropping a towel over the cage in the back seat of his truck. "I'm always walking," Carney sang, "after midnight." I couldn't look at Mom. I knew she was crying. I was relieved to see Carney go, to have the burden of his welfare hoisted onto someone else's shoulders. But immediately I was brought back to the sadness of the moment, the fact that this day represented a breaking-off point. There was an air of finality, my mother grieving in the car, our small home empty. After the plumber pulled away, I walked through the house one last time. I could almost hear the place settling, breathing a sigh of relief, coming down from a high. Still, there was a palpable residue of our past lives, as if old fights and parrot tirades had left their marks. I paused over my father's plaster fixes and custom molding, things shaped by his hands that I couldn't take with me. Empty, the house reminded me of a tombstone, a commemoration of my childhood. With the shopping center going up next door, I had the feeling no one else would ever live there again. I joined Mom in the car. I imagined her stillness and set face belied inner fragility, as if beneath the crust lay a deep well of hurt. As I turned onto the highway, I saw her touch her shoulder, the place where Carney had so often rested, his remembered weight now a phantom presence on her thinning bones. We've been driving I-95 toward home for 5 hours. Ike has been in and out of naps. We pass a billboard that says, "Jesus is watching." "Jesus makes me nervous," Ike says. "Jesus is a spy." I laugh and then pause, thinking how the statement would have made Mom uncomfortable. The night sets in and Ike gets quiet. I watch his eyes in the rear view. I wonder what he's thinking about. "Will you love me forever?" I think to myself. "Will you love me when I'm old, if I go crazy? Will you be embarrassed of me, avoid my calls, wash dishes when you talk to me on the phone, roll your eyes, lay the receiver down next to the cat?" I realize how badly I need a piece of my mother, a scrap, a sound, a smell, something. I hunger for the person who birthed me, whose body, I realize, after becoming a mother myself, was overrun with nerve endings that ran straight to her heart until it was numb with overuse, or until, perhaps, she felt nothing. "One more stop," I say to Ike. We pull into the dark gravel driveway to my mother's house. There's no neighborhood, no signage. It's just a deserted plain house for plain folks on what is now a major highway. The white paint peels from the siding. I remember pulling into this driveway when I was past curfew, the light in my mother's bedroom glowing, the way I could simultaneously dread and love the thought of slipping through the front door, pouring a glass of water and crafting an elaborate lie to explain my late arrival. Ike is sleepy. He's wearing my rain jacket and has the hood cinched tightly to his face, though it's barely raining. RVs are pulling into the Walmart parking lot for the night. The smell of wet leaves makes me sick to my stomach with nostalgia. The boxwoods are overgrown and shapeless. "Hold my hand," I say to Ike. "Stay close." The screen door is still intact, though the screen itself is punctured and webbed over. I hold it open, stare into the dirty glass of the front door. I try the knob. Locked. "I have to go in," I say. "Close your eyes." I break the front door pane with the butt of the knife I carry in my purse and carefully reach in through the mouth of glass teeth to turn the doorknob. "This is weird," Ike says. "I'm scared." I clench his wrist. My knuckles are cold and I worry that my grip on Ike's arm is too tight, but I do not let go. The damp carpet heaves underneath my feet. The house smells like a cave and yet like home. Checkered contact paper still lines the pantry shelves. Windows are cracked. Sills are covered in dead wasps and crumpled spiders. There's mold on the drywall and water spots on the ceiling. Someone has taken red spray paint to the fireplace and living room wall. The stove and toilet have been ripped out. Ike starts to cry. "It's okay," I say. "I just want to stay here a minute." I lead him to the back of the house, down the hallway, which still feels more familiar to me than any I know. My bedroom, with its teal carpet and pale pink walls, looks small, barren. At first, it's so quiet my teeth ache, my ears strain. "I'm sad that you lived here," Ike says, still crying. "It wasn't that bad, honey," I say. "This was a beautiful house." The crown molding my father installed is still up, though one piece is loose and sags. I remember him getting up early so that he could work on it before heading to the factory. It was my mother's birthday present, crown molding for my room. My father died on the steps of the tool manufacturing plant, not 10 minutes down the road. A heart attack. The doctor said it was a birth defect, that he was born with a weak heart. And now the building is empty, abandoned, as if all his work was for nothing. Mom's grief was as long as a river, endless. I walk back to the kitchen and climb onto the green plastic countertop. Ike watches me, curious and confused. I remove the valances Mom made in the early 80s, dried bugs falling from the folds of the fabric into the sink below. These are the things with which she made a home. Her contributions to our sense of place were humble and put forth with great intent, crafts which took weeks of stitching and unstitching, measuring, cutting, gathering. I realize how much in the home was done by hand and sweat. My father had laid the carpeting and linoleum. Mom had painted and reupholstered the same dinner chairs twice, sewed all the window treatments. My parents were quick fix averse, always in for the long haul. When the country road in front of the house had been widened to a highway, they complained, but never entertained the idea of moving. I scan the kitchen and picture Mom paying bills, her perfect script, the way she always listed her occupation with pride, homemaker. I pull scraps of peeling wallpaper from unglued seams and corners. It comes off slow and steady like skin after a sunburn. The old adhesive gives easily. Mementos, I tell Ike. I close my eyes. Now I can hear my mother everywhere, in the kitchen, in my bedroom, on the front porch. Turn off the television. Warm up the stove. Brush your hair. Put your father's shoes where I can't see them, in the trash. On Sunday, as promised, my realtor arrives a half hour before the potential buyers and their home inspector. Your house should look as perfect as possible, he'd said before I left for the weekend. Ask yourself, what would Jackie Onassis do? Ike and I had come home to a spare house. Some of our chairs, photographs, and Ike's art had been relocated, as the realtor had suggested, to let the space breathe. When I see the realtor's convertible in the driveway, I ask Ike, "Think you can box up the mini NASCARs and finger puppets?" "Sorry I'm late," our realtor says. He rushes to the kitchen as if he has immediately sensed disorder. He strokes the valance over the kitchen window. I remembered last night, as I was hanging it, that Mom had found the pattern in Southern Living. "Is this velvet?" he says. "Are these cobwebs?" I have placed scraps of rogue wallpaper next to my stove and another in the bathroom, a repeating pattern of pale brown cornucopias and faded fruit I took from my mother's house. "These must come down," the realtor says. "Now." He pinches the curling shreds with his thumb and forefinger. "Leave it," I say. "They add charm." "You'll never sell this house," he says, shaking his head in despair. "Crickets on speed and a valance that Elvis made in home economics class. Get serious." "Apple pie?" I ask, pulling out a day-old pastry I'd purchased from the market's discount bread bin that morning. I've steeled myself against critique. There are too many things I can't fix. A couple in a minivan pulls up in front of the house, followed by the home inspector in a pickup truck. They come to the door, their faces already twisted with scrutiny. She is small and blonde, and he is thick like an old football player. "Hi," I say. "Welcome. We're about to head out. The house is all yours." I stuff some magazines and soda into a canvas bag and look around for Ike. I hear him running up the basement steps. He presents a scrap of siding that's covered in glue and cricket exoskeletons. The couple exchange a glance. The inspector scribbles a note. I crouch down to the floor and touch Ike's cheeks. "You're brave," I say. "Thank you." Ike grins. Together we can make a solid grilled cheese, prune shrubs, clean house. Together, maybe we're the housewife this house needs. Maybe our best life is here. On a good day, we're just one man short of a catalog-worthy family. A week before she left for the nursing home, we packed my mother's belongings, robes, slippers, and lotions that could do little good for her sagging face. Her diminished vision made it hard for her to read the labels on the boxes. Ike had just started kindergarten. Leaving him at a friend's house to spend time with Mom on a Saturday was a miserable trade-off. I wanted to soak up every last bit of innocence he had left, answer every question, scoop him up for hugs when he'd allow it. But I was the only person Mom would allow in the house. There was no one else around to help. I held up various tchotchkes for Mom's approval. "Take or toss?" I asked. Mom sat in her recliner. She wore a light blue dress she'd made herself. The fabric was so worn it was nearly transparent. Carney rested comfortably on her shoulder. I worried that his talons would break her thinning skin, but she moved as if she hardly noticed his weight. I held up a box of ornaments, plastic apples I'd hand-painted for her as a child. "Toss 'em," she'd said. I began to wrap her glassware in newspaper. "Make sure to leave plenty of print for lining Carney's cage," she said. My mother cupped Carney with both hands and brought him to her lap. She crossed her legs and scratched the finger-wide point between Carney's wings. His eyes, like little black seeds, fell to half-mast as she stroked him. They were accustomed to each other, a pair of sad habits. He was more familiar with her voice and touch than I, more dear to her everyday existence. His transgressions, dirty cage, the occasional nip of her finger, were met with gentle understanding. "Don't call here again," he said. "Don't call." "Remember," I told my mother, "I'm not obligated to look after that bird." "Well," she said, "I'm not obligated to look after you." "You are," I'd thought at the time, her words a splinter in my chest. "You have to be." In that moment I withered. I hated her for her coldness, her stubborn rationale, her ability to come up big in a fight even when she was dog-tired and bird-boned and couldn't see the food on the end of her fork. There she sat, outmoded in her homemade dress, bird in her lap, shit on her shoulder. Steamrolled by the world, but in face of defeat, she threatened us all. Carney moved back to her shoulder and buried his head into her thin hair. It occurred to me that with her voice inside of him, he would always have more of her to remember. "You don't want to keep these?" I asked, giving her a second chance on a box of photographs. "My heart," she'd said, "I can turn it off." For years I believed her. But I know the truth now. What maniacs we are, sick with love, all of us. And that story was Housewifely Arts by Megan Mayhew Bergen, from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The Duchess and the Jeweler by Virginia Woolf. Oliver Bacon lived at the top of a house overlooking the Green Park. He had a flat, chairs jutted out at the right angles, chairs covered in hide, sofas filled the bays of the windows, sofas covered in tapestry. The windows, the three long windows, had the proper allowance of discreet net and figured satin. The mahogany sideboard bulged discreetly with the right brandies, whiskies, and liqueurs. And from the middle window, he looked down upon the glossy roofs of fashionable cars packed in the narrow straits of Piccadilly. A more central position could not be imagined. And at 8 in the morning, he would have his breakfast brought in on a tray by a manservant. The manservant would unfold his crimson dressing gown. He would rip his letters open with his long pointed nails and would extract thick white cards of invitation, upon which the engraving stood up roughly from duchesses, countesses, viscountesses, and honorable ladies. Then he would wash, then he would eat his toast, then he would read his paper by the bright burning fire of electric coals. "Behold, Oliver," he would say, addressing himself, "you who began life in a filthy little alley, you who..." And he would look down at his legs, so shapely in their perfect trousers, at his boots, at his spats. They were all shapely, shining, cut from the best cloth by the best scissors in Savile Row. But he dismantled himself often and became again a little boy in a dark alley. He had once thought that the height of his ambition, selling stolen dogs to fashionable women in Whitechapel, and once he had been done... "Oh, Oliver," his mother had wailed, "oh, Oliver, when will you have any sense, my son?" Then he had gone behind a counter, had sold cheap watches, then he had taken a wallet to Amsterdam. At that memory he would chuckle, the old Oliver remembering the young. Yes, he had done well with the 3 diamonds. Also, there was the commission on the emerald. After that he went into the private room behind the shop in Hatton Garden, the room with the scales, the safe, the thick magnifying glasses. And then, he chuckled. When he passed through the knots of jewelers in the hot evening who were discussing prices, gold mines, diamonds, reports from South Africa, One of them would lay a finger to the side of his nose and murmur, "Mmm," as he passed. It was no more than a murmur, no more than a nudge on the shoulder, a finger on the nose, a buzz that ran through the cluster of jewelers in Hatton Garden on a hot afternoon, oh, many years ago now. But still Oliver felt it purring down his spine, the nudge, the murmur that meant, "Look at him, young Oliver, the young jeweler, there he goes." Young he was then, and he dressed better and better, and had first a hansom cab, then a car, and first he went up to the dress circle, then down into the stalls. And he had a villa at Richmond, overlooking the river, with trellises of red roses, and Mademoiselle used to pick one every morning and stick it in his buttonhole. "So," said Oliver Bacon, rising and stretching his legs, "so." And he stood beneath the picture of an old lady on the mantelpiece and raised his hands. "I have kept my word," he said, laying his hands together, palm to palm, as if he were doing homage to her. "I have won my bet." That was so. He was the richest jeweler in England. But his nose, which was long and flexible like an elephant's trunk, seemed to say by its curious quiver at the nostrils, but it seemed as if the whole nose quivered, not only the nostrils, that he was not satisfied yet, still smelt something under the ground a little further off. Imagine a giant hog in a pasture rich with truffles. After unearthing this truffle and that, still it smells a bigger, a blacker truffle under the ground further off. So Oliver snuffed always in the rich earth of Mayfair another truffle, a blacker, a bigger, further off. Now then he straightened the pearl in his tie, cased himself in his smart blue overcoat, took his yellow gloves and his cane, and swayed as he descended the stairs and half-snuffed, half-sighed through his long, sharp nose as he passed out into Piccadilly. For was he not still a sad man, a dissatisfied man, a man who seeks something that is hidden, though he has won his bet? He swayed slightly as he walked, as a camel at the zoo sways from side to side when it walks along the asphalt paths laden with grocers and their wives, eating from paper bags and throwing little bits of silver paper crumpled up onto the path. The camel despises the grocers. The camel is dissatisfied with its lot. The camel sees a blue lake and the fringe of palm trees in front of it. So the great jeweler, the greatest jeweler in the whole world, swung down Piccadilly, perfectly dressed, with his gloves, with his cane, but dissatisfied still till he reached the dark little shop that was famous in France and Germany and Austria and Italy and all over America, the dark little shop in the street off Bond Street. As usual, he strode through the shop without speaking, though the four men, the two old men, Marshall and Spencer, and the two young men, Hammond and Wicks, stood straight and looked at him, envying him. It was only with one finger of the amber-colored glove waggling that he acknowledged their presence, and he went in and shut the door of his private room behind him. Then he unlocked the grating that barred the window. The cries of Bond Street came in, the purr of the distant traffic. The light from reflectors at the back of the shop struck upwards. One tree waved six green leaves, for it was June. But Mademoiselle had married Mr. Petter of the local brewery. No one stuck roses in his buttonhole now. So, he half sighed, half snorted, so. Then he touched a spring in the wall, and slowly the paneling slid open, and behind it were the steel safes, five, no, six of them, all of burnished steel. He twisted a key, unlocked one, and then another. Each was lined with a pad of deep crimson velvet. In each lay jewels, bracelets, necklaces, rings, tiaras, ducal coronets, loose stones and glass shells, rubies, emeralds, pearls, diamonds, all safe, shining, cool, yet burning eternally with their own compressed light. "Tears," said Oliver, looking at the pearls. "Heart's blood," he said, looking at the rubies. "Gunpowder," he continued, rattling the diamonds so that they flashed and blazed. "Gunpowder enough to blow Mayfair. Sky high, high, high." He threw his head back and made a sound like a horse neighing as he said it. The telephone buzzed obsequiously in a low, muted voice on his table. He shut the safe. "In 10 minutes," he said, "not before." And he sat down at his desk and looked at the heads of the Roman emperors that were graved on his sleeve links. And again he dismantled himself and became once more the little boy playing marbles in the alley where they sell stolen dogs on Sunday. He became that wily, astute little boy with lips like wet cherries. He dabbled his fingers in ropes of tripe. He dipped them in pans of frying fish. He dodged in and out among the crowds. He was slim, lissome, with eyes like licked stones. And now the hands of the clock ticked on. 1, 2, 3, 4. The Duchess of Lambourne waited his pleasure. The Duchess of Lambourne, daughter of 100 earls. She would wait for 10 minutes on a chair at the counter. She would wait his pleasure. She would wait till he was ready to see her. He watched the clock in its shagreen case. The hand moved on. With each tick the clock handed him, so it seemed, pâté de foie gras, a glass of champagne, another of fine brandy, a cigar costing 1 guinea. The clock laid them on the table beside him as the 10 minutes passed. Then he heard soft, slow footsteps approaching, a rustle in the corridor. The door opened. Mr. Hammond flattened himself against the wall. "Her Grace," he announced, and he waited there, flattened against the wall. And Oliver, rising, could hear the rustle of the dress of the Duchess as she came down the passage. Then she loomed up, filling the door, filling the room with the aroma, the prestige, the arrogance, the pomp, the pride of all the dukes and duchesses swollen in one wave. And as the wave breaks, she broke, as she sat down, spreading and splashing and falling over Oliver Bacon, the great jeweler, covering him with sparkling bright colors, green, rose, violet, and odors and iridescences, and rays shooting from fingers, nodding from plumes, flashing from silk, for she was very large, very fat, tightly girt in pink taffeta and past her prime. As a parasol with many flounces, as a peacock with many feathers, shuts its flounces, folds its feathers, so she subsided and shut herself as she sank down in the leather armchair. "Good morning, Mr. Bacon," said the Duchess, and she held out her hand, which came through the slit of her white glove, and Oliver bent low as he shook it, and as their hands touched, the link was forged between them once more. They were friends, yet enemies. He was master, she was mistress. Each cheated the other, each needed the other, each feared the other. Each felt this and knew this every time they touched hands thus in the little back room with the white light outside, and the tree with its 6 leaves, and the sound of the street in the distance, and behind them the safes. "And today, Duchess, what can I do for you today?" said Oliver very softly. The Duchess opened her heart, her private heart, gaped wide, and with a sigh but no word, she took from her bag a long, wash-leather pouch. It looked like a lean yellow ferret, and from a slit in the ferret's belly she dropped pearls, 10 pearls. They rolled from the slit in the ferret's belly, 1, 2, 3, 4, like the eggs of some heavenly bird. "All that's left me, dear Mr. Bacon," she moaned. 5, 6, 7. Down they rolled, down the slopes of the vast mountainsides that fell between her knees into one narrow valley, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th. There they lay in the glow of the peach-blossom taffeta, 10 pearls. "From the Appleby cincture," she mourned. The last of them all." Oliver stretched out and took one of the pearls between finger and thumb. It was round, it was lustrous. But real was it, or false? Was she lying again? Did she dare? She laid her plump, padded finger across her lips. "If the Duke knew," she whispered. "Dear Mr. Bacon, a bit of bad luck. Been gambling again, had she?" "That villain, that sharper," she hissed. "The man with the chipped cheekbone? A bad un." And the Duke was straight as a poker with side whiskers. Would cut her off, shut her up down there, if he knew what I know, thought Oliver, and glanced at the safe. "Araminta, Daphne, Diana," she moaned. "It's for them." The ladies Araminta, Daphne, Diana, her daughters. He knew them, adored them. But it was Diana he loved. "You have all my secrets," she leered. Tears slid, tears fell, tears like diamonds collecting powder in the ruts of her cherry-blossom cheeks. "Old friend," she murmured, "old friend." "Old friend," he repeated, "old friend," as if he licked the words. "How much?" he queried. She covered the pearls with her hand. 20,000, she whispered. Was it real or false, the one he held in his hand? The Appleby cincture. Hadn't she sold it already? He would ring for Spencer or Hammond. "Take it and test it," he would say. He stretched to the bell. "You will come down tomorrow," she urged. She interrupted. "The Prime Minister, His Royal Highness." She stopped. "And Diana," she added. Oliver took his hand off the bell. He looked past her at the backs of the houses in Bond Street, but he saw not the houses in Bond Street, but a dimpling river, and trout rising, and salmon, and the Prime Minister, and himself too, in white waistcoat, and then Diana. He looked down at the pearl in his hand, but how could he test it in the light of the river, in the light of the eyes of Diana? But the eyes of the Duchess were on him. 20,000, she moaned. "My honor! The honor of the mother of Diana!" He drew his checkbook towards him. He took out his pen. 20, he wrote. Then he stopped writing. The eyes of the old woman in the picture were on him, of the old woman, his mother. "Oliver," she warned him, "have sense. Don't be a fool." "Oliver," the Duchess entreated. It was Oliver now, not Mr. Bacon. "You'll come for a long weekend?" "Alone in the woods with Diana. Riding alone in the woods with Diana." 1,000, he wrote, and signed it. "Here you are," he said. And there opened all the flounces of the parasol, all the plumes of the peacock, the radiance of the wave, the swords and spears of Agincourt as she rose from her chair. And the two old men and the two young men, Spencer and Marshall, Wicks and Hammond, flattened themselves behind the counter, envying him as he led her through the shop to the door. And he waggled his yellow glove in their faces, and she held her honor, a check for £20,000 with his signature, quite firmly in her hands. "Are they false, or are they real?" asked Oliver, shutting his private door. There they were, 10 pearls on the blotting paper on the table. He took them to the window. He held them under his lens to the light. This, then, was a truffle he had routed out of the earth. Rotten at the center, rotten at the core. "Forgive me, O my mother," he sighed, raising his hand as if he asked pardon of the old woman in the picture. And again he was a little boy in the alley where they sold dogs on Sunday. "For," he murmured, laying the palms of his hands together, "it is to be a long weekend." And that story was The Duchess and the Jeweler by Virginia Woolf from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Heart Attack by Max Apple. My sickness bothers me, though I persist in denying it. It is indigestion, I think, and eat no onions, gout, and I order no liver or goose. The possibility of nervous exhaustion keeps me abed for 3 days, breathing deeply. I do yoga for anxiety. But finally, here I am, amid magazines awaiting, naked to the waist, cough at the balls, needle in the vein. From my viral pneumonia days, I remember his Schaefer's desk set and the 14-karat gold point. It writes prescriptions without a scratch. In the time of the bad sunburn, my damaged eyes scanned the walls, reading degrees and being jealous of the good-looking woman, the 3 boys, the weeping willow in the backyard. I have a choice of Sports Illustrated, Time, Boys World, others. As if by design, I choose the free pamphlet on the wall. Fleischmann's margarine gives me some straight talk about cholesterol. I remember the 10,000 eggs of my youth, those miracles of protein that have perhaps made my interior an art gum eraser. Too overeasy in the morning, a hard one every night, poached, sometimes eviscerated by mayonnaise. In many ways, I've been an egg man. The pamphlet shows my heart, a small pump the size of my fist. I make a fist and stare at knuckles, white as the eggshells I wish I had eaten instead. Where did I learn that your penis is the size of your middle finger plus the distance that finger can reach down your arm? Mine cannot make it to the wrist. My heart, too, must be a pea in this flimsy, hairless chest. From a door marked private, a nurse, all in white, comes to me. She sits very close on the couch and looks down at my pamphlet. She takes my damp hand in hers and tickles my palm. Her soft lips against my ear whisper musically, "Every cloud has a silver lining." "But arteries," I respond. "My arteries are caked with the mistakes of my youth." She points to the pamphlet. "Arteries should be lined only with their moist little selves. Be good to your arteries. Be kind to your heart. It's the only one you'll ever have." She puts her tongue in my ear, and one arm reaches under my shirt. She sings, "A fella needs a girl." "I need a doctor. My arteries." She points again to the pamphlet and reads, Arteries, though similar to, are more important than girls in several ways. Look at this one, pink and flexible as a spidal band. Over there threatens cholesterol, dark as motor oil, thick as birthday cake. Cholesterol is the bully of the body. It picks on blood, good, honest blood, who bothers no one and goes happily between the races, creeds, and colors. I have pains, I tell her, pains in my chest, and my tongue feels fat, and moss grows in my joints. She unbuttons my shirt slowly. Her long, cool fingers cup me as if I were all breasts. Her clever right hand is at my back, counting vertebrae. She takes off the stiff nurse's cap and nuzzles my solar plexus. Into my middle she hums, I'm as corny as Kansas in August. The vibrations go deep. She responds to me. There, I gasp, right there. I am overcome as if by Valium. As I moan, she moves me down on the crackling vinyl couch. Her lips, teeth, and tongue fire between my ribs. She hums Muzak, and the room spins until I sight the pamphlet clinging to the bobby pin. In my ecstasy, I see the diagram of cholesterol, in peaks and valleys, nipping at blood that makes its way like a hero through the narrow places. When she lets me up, I am bruised but feeling wonderful. Her lips are colorless from the pressure she has exerted upon me. I start to take off my trousers. She stays my hand at the belt buckle, kisses me long. The oath, she whispers. I'm cured, I say. Forget him. Forget the urine and the blood. Look! I beat my chest like Tarzan. I spit across the room into a tiny bronze ashtray. I'll pack, she says. She goes into private while I pick out a few Reader's Digests for the road, Today's Health for the bathroom. She returns carrying a centrifuge and a rack of test tubes. We embrace, then I bend to help her with her things. Don't be cruel, she whispers, to a heart that's true. On the way out, we throw a kiss to the pharmacist, and my blood slips through. And that story was Heart Attack by Max Apple from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.